This show is not a substitute for professional counseling, and no relationship is created between the show hosts or guests and any listener. If you feel you are in need of professional mental health and are a UA student, we encourage you to contact the UA Counseling Center at 348-3863. If you are not a UA student, please contact your respective county's crisis service hotline or their local mental health agency or insurance company. If it is an emergency situation, please call 911 or go to your nearest emergency room.
It's 6 o'clock and time again for Brain Matters, the official radio show of the UA Counseling Center. We are broadcasting from the campus of the University of Alabama. Good evening. My name is Dr. B.J. Gunther, and I'm the host of the show, along with my colleague and producer, Catherine Howell. In case you don't know, this show is about mental and physical health issues that affect college students, and in particular, UA students. So you can listen to us each Tuesday night at 6 p.m. on 90.7 FM, or you can listen online at wbuafm.ua.edu, or you can also download the Crimson White app and just click on the 90.7 live streaming link. Also, we're midterm right now, but we have most of our shows planned out till the end of the semester. I think we've got shows going up to until right after Thanksgiving, because we'll break for the winter break. I think it's the first week in December. Catherine, do you know when finals are? I'm not sure either, but it's usually that first week in December. So we've got a few more shows. We're midway, and we've got most of our shows already booked. And I'm going to need some ideas for the spring semester shows. So I always ask people to send those show topic ideas in to me. Email those to me at brainmattersradio@wbuafm.ua.edu. And of course, I'll consider using those show topics. I hope I can remember to give out this email. I always forget sporadically throughout the show. Catherine is very good at helping me remember. So you'll have an opportunity to go ahead and send me those emails if you have topic ideas. But tonight's topic it's very interesting, and I think it's a good and timely topic for right now, since I did mention it's midterm, and we're having more calls for same-day consults, more crisis calls, more appointments that are wanting to be made, just because of the stress that students are under right now at this time in the semester. The topic tonight is the habits of stress-resilient people. And at the beginning of the semester, we used to go out and talk to classes about resiliency and adjustment issues right at the beginning of the semester, because that's when a lot of, you know, freshmen that are just coming in, they're needing to develop some resiliency. And I could tell you some funny stories about just some things that, you know, students have told me that they've had to learn to adapt to. Tonight, I've got to get my guest. I'm going to introduce him in just a minute, but I always do a little bit of research for the show before the show, so I kind of know a little bit more about the background of my topic. And I found something from a presentation by a couple of psychologists from the Counseling Center at Bentley University in Massachusetts, which I'd never heard of Bentley University, but this presentation was excellent. And they said, "I've done a considerable amount of reading and research in recent months on the topic of resilience in college students. Our students are no different from what is being reported across the country on the state of late adolescence and early adulthood. There's been an increase in diagnosable mental health problems, but there has also been a decrease in the ability of many young people to manage the everyday bumps in the road of life. Whether we want it or not, these students are bringing their struggles to their teachers and others on campus who deal with students on a day-to-day basis. The lack of resilience in interfering with the academic mission of the university and its thwarting, that's an unusual word, the emotional and personal development of students." And even though that was probably meant for their university, I think it's across the board, probably same for most universities and colleges, even community colleges. My guest tonight is Dr. Christian Waugh. Dr. Waugh is an associate professor of psychology at Wake Forest University in North Carolina and an expert in the study of stress resilience, emotions, and effective coping habits. His research has been featured in scientific journals and on television and reveals individual differences in resilience as the result of stress, trauma, and the ability to experience positive emotions in times of stress. Thanks for being on the show, Dr. Waugh.
Thanks for having me.
I came across, and I think I sent this to you when I invited you to be on the show. I came across your information because I was invited to a presentation through an association that you provided a presentation about this subject. And I thought this really, this is something I'm not sure. We've talked about stress management on the show before, but I don't know if we've really ever talked specifically about resilience.
Right.
So tell the listeners, before we get into the topic, tell the listeners about yourself, your credentials, even more detailed of what I just announced, and why you're interested in this topic.
Sure. So I grew up in Maryland on the East Coast and went to undergrad at William & Mary, where I got interested in psychology, especially sort of the kind of evolutionary side of psychology, sort of the big answering the big whys of why things happen, which I mentioned because it kind of forms the foundation of how I approach things, you know, not just looking at the current moment, but looking at the greater context of the moment that we're in, which I think is important for resilience. We'll talk more about that in a minute. Then I went to the University of Michigan, where I worked with Barb Fredrickson, who's an expert, a leading expert in positive emotions and resilience research. So I really got into positive emotions as a stress regulation tool there. In fact, one of the first big papers I was on was looking at resilience in the wake of the 9/11 attacks, is extraordinarily, important and like this watershed moment for people like you or me. I've noticed that for our students, it's becoming more and more of like a, you know, my parents told me about 9/11.
Just hit that here. Yeah. They didn't even know. I mean, they knew about it, but it didn't affect them like it did those of us who were alive.
And that's almost a good thing, right? You kind of want to progress past that, you know? So our students will have the pandemic as their sort of watershed moment, I'm sure.
Yeah.
We did a lot of research on 9/11 and how people coped with it successfully and were resilient with it. And and we really, you know, positive emotions were the thing that kept coming up and up and up as the most active ingredient in how people coped the best with it. And in fact, we saw a lot of negative emotions from basically everybody. So it wasn't really the presence of negative emotions that was the problem. It was the absence of positive emotions. So that got me really on this path. I started looking at neuroimaging, look at the brain of resilient people and emotions and emotion regulation. And I've been at Wake Forest for the last almost 12 years now, 11, 12 years now, trying to discover these topics, really trying to understand how people use positive emotions to regulate their stressors, how that works on a microscopic scale.
Yes.
From one moment to the next, as more as a macroscopic scale from, you know, the big chronic life stressors, like the pandemic, for example.
You know, I want you to define resiliency for us. I think of when I think of the word resiliency, I think of somebody who can bounce back quickly. But define what resiliency really means.
Yeah, so it's basically adapting and thriving through the constant challenges and stressors that one is exposed to throughout their lives. So what I like about that sort of definition is it's not just adapting, but it's also thriving. It's not just being
surviving,
like neutral or surviving. Yeah. It's also thriving too. Being an active participant in your own life, if you will. And it sort of also acknowledges that these are constant challenges and everybody goes through these stressors and challenges to some degree. You know, some challenges are bigger than others. Some stressors are more constant than others, but everybody goes through them to some degree. And those who exhibit resilience are those who can do so without really succumbing to psychopathology or really major disruptions in their functioning.
I don't know how to ask this, but I'm going to try. How do you know if someone is not developing resiliency? And I use that in the terms of, like, and maybe you've studied this and researched this, I use that in the terms of like for a college student. You know, is a year long enough for somebody to develop habits, you know, to be resilient? Or if it's a year and you can tell that they're not just, you know, does that make sense? Is that a good question?
It does make sense. And this is at this point where it's important to like point out that even though I used to think this, I no longer think this. I no longer think of people as resilient or not. I think of resilience as a process that is to some degree stronger or weaker in a certain context, in certain people at a certain time. So that's really important. So you can actually be fairly resilient, if you will, to certain types of stressors, but maybe actually a little bit more sensitive to other types of stressors, right? Mm-hmm. So you crush it at work and everything that they throw at you at work is great, but then your social life is maybe a mess, right? So it's not just one blanket resilience. And I think that's also important when we look at our students, right? It's not only how are they coping with the next test or the fact that they have two papers next week, but how are they also coping in the other domains of their lives?
Yeah.
And it's really the most problematic when you see that they're not doing well in multiple domains of their lives, right? Because that points to a bigger problem that, and so as far as identifying those who have resilience or not, it's really about in this moment, are you able to appropriately respond to these types of stressors? That doesn't mean that you don't feel negative emotion.
Right.
It means you feel the right amount of negative emotion with hopefully a sense of control if you have it, or a sense of acceptance if you don't have control, right? And are you able to sort of flexibly bounce between those two strategies? So for me, my biggest indicator that someone is in this moment not exhibiting the resilience that they could is when they get very rigid responding, when they start responding to all types of situations, the same negative type of coping strategy that may not be working as well, which then leads to potentially bad outcomes down the line.
And for us here on the University of Alabama campus, it would be students who jump through the drive-through window at Jack's and not wearing clothes. That's when you know somebody's not being very resilient at that time. And we could probably have a whole show about how they, you know, whatever.
Yeah.
Alcohol and other substances.
Right.
That's a sidebar. Right. You know, you mentioned in your research looking at brain images.
Yeah.
Which is fascinating to me. And I want you to talk a little bit about the connection between stress and the brain and what you saw on those brain images.
Well, what was really cool is we did a study where we looked at people who scored higher or lower on this personality inventory, that kind of index resilience.
Uh-huh.
And we gave them a task where they had these cues that they predicted either bad things or ambiguous things, like it could be good or could be bad. And we showed that people who are less resilient on this measure responded to in their brain to both types of cues similarly. So like the bad things were bad, but also these things that could be good or could be bad were bad, right? Whereas the more resilient people are in that moment who scored higher on this resilience measure differentiated between the two. So it was almost like they were keeping in mind the possibility that, yeah, this could be bad, but it could be good as well. And kind of reserving the totality of their judgment, if you will, for when they saw what happened.
Yes. And that was my next question is what about I read an article about their perceptions. You know, if people perceive themselves as optimistic as opposed to pessimistic, did that you might not have looked at that, but that would be an interesting study to factor in if they perceive themselves as resilient and then it shows the opposite on their brain images.
Oh, so
I don't know if that's possible.
So what's funny about that is our self-perceptions can obviously sometimes be a little bit off, if you will.
Skewed, yeah.
But a lot of times it's, they're also what sort of drive our behavior as well. If we think of ourselves as optimistic people, then we tend to then also behave in the world such that we're optimistic people, right? At least within a couple of degrees. It's not like, you know, unless we're, you know, very self-delusional. So in this particular instance, it was people who self-identified as higher on this resilience personality measure were showing these traits of flexibility and stuff like that.
Mm-hmm. Let's take a break. And then when we come back, I want to ask you, if you can, talk a little bit. We talked about the brain, but let's talk about stress in the body and also how fear and anxiety, you know, affect the body, cortisol and all that, because I read a lot about that too in some of the research that I did for the show. So stay tuned. You're listening to Brain Matters on 90.7 The Capstone.
WVUA-FM, Tuscaloosa.
This show is not a substitute for professional counseling, and no relationship is created between the show hosts or guests and any listener. If you feel you are in need of professional mental health and are a UA student, we encourage you to contact the UA Counseling Center at 348-3863. If you are not a UA student, please contact your respective county's crisis service hotline or their local mental health agency or insurance company. If it is an emergency situation, please call 911 or go to your nearest emergency room.
Back listening to Brain Matters on 90.7 The Capstone. I'm Dr. BJ Gunther. If you want to email us any questions, or you have questions for myself or my guest tonight, you can email those to brainmattersradio@wvuafm.ua.edu. We're talking tonight about the habits of stress-resilient people, and my guest is Dr. Christian Wall, excuse me, and he's at Wake Forest University, so you're on a college campus also.
Yep.
So you can totally relate to what I'm talking about. What's the enrollment at Wake Forest?
I believe it's between 5,000 and 6,000, 5,500-ish undergrad.
Yeah. So. You know, for us, like I said, we're coming up on midterms right now, so we're seeing a lot more students who I think they need to be taught, and I try to help them. You know, I think all of our therapists do with how to be more resilient. But a lot of them come in with just this all or nothing thinking, right? So it's hard to help them kind of not just manage it, but calm themselves down and soothe themselves to realize you can handle this. We can do this, you know, because they're just in a panic.
Yeah. There does seem to be a zeitgeist out there that, that there's almost like resilience is not as valued maybe as it used to be.
That's right.
And not as explicitly taught, and sort of kind of engendered in our kids. Basically.
That's right. When we left off before the break, I wanted to ask, you were talking about brain imaging and the connection between stress and the brain. I want to talk now about the connection between stress and the body. What does it do to your body? What does it do for you to have fear and anxiety? How does that affect, what is cortisol levels? I mentioned that before the break. Give us some details.
Sure. So here's my stress in the body lesson for my class in 2 minutes or less. So when you are experiencing a particular episode of stress, first of all, if it's acute, right? So if it's something that's like suddenly happening to you, like right now, and you have to deal with it right now, you know, we have heart rate increasing, and sometimes we'll have cortisol increasing if it's something particularly uncontrollable or evaluative. But those are actually fairly functional adaptive responses that are there to kind of energize our body and give us the fuel to try to deal with the situation in hand. That is not the problem. The problem is when that stressor is not acute. It's sort of something that's kind of online
for
a long period of time. Mm-hmm. And what ways that we do this, so anxiety is a great example of this. So humans are like, you know, the reason why we can build skyscrapers is that we can project and plan into the future. That's also the same reason why we get super anxious about something 2 weeks away, is because we can project and plan into the future. What we do is we're essentially taking that event that's in the future and having its impact on us from now till then. So now you have this extended period of time where you're under a particular type of stress, and your body doesn't like that. It's not really, it didn't really evolve to like deal with that very, very well. So it's kind of things start switching on you, where instead of being energized, the cortisol starts tricking your immune system into thinking you're sick, for example, and then you get very de-energized and irritable. Your body says, oh, you might need to stay awake longer because you clearly think there are threats in the environment, so you shouldn't go to sleep. So then you don't sleep very well, and you don't sleep, you don't get to sleep early enough. You look for, one of the big things is that your body also says, don't worry about long-term goals that you have, like really worry about what's going on now as a way to try to fix things. And this is when you start using coping tools that are really about the immediate gratification, like substance abuse, eating and stuff like that. Because it's like almost like saying, let's give up on trying to solve the long-term problem. Let's just solve our short-term problem by trying to forget about it, avoid it, or kind of eat through it, which also obviously can affect your body indirectly. So yeah, it's, and then this has the real fun part about this is this reciprocal, right? So now you start having these bodily issues where you're tired and tense, maybe also your muscles.
Irritable too.
And irritable. And then you start becoming almost like, stressed because of those things. Right. And then it sort of cycles down and down and down. And then if you're not able to stop it in the middle, if you're not able to kind of curb the cycle, it can be problematic. And now you're basically so stressed that you can't think straight. And, you maybe are getting diagnosed with anxiety disorder, depression, or other sorts of things.
That's right. You get, and a lot of people will feel trapped, like they don't know how to help themselves at that point because it's gotten so bad. What are the traits of resilient people?
So the traits of resilience in a particular person's life, right? So instead of like resilient people per se, like what would resilience look like in a moment in one's life? It would look like someone in that particular period of their life who are able to flexibly adjust the way they meet the demands of the environment, right? So flexibility is a big, big part of this. So this is why also resilience is a little bit of a different topic. It's almost like a meta topic than just learning about coping strategies. So it's like the way I liken it is this. I just, when I moved to North Carolina, I knew nothing about woodworking, right? I knew nothing about it. I was like this suburban kid from Baltimore, Maryland. Like I didn't do any of that.
You moved North to the Carolina, capital of deal. Furniture making.
It is the capital for like Hickory is down the road. Okay.
Exactly. High Point.
So, I had to adapt to my new environment, learn some woodworking. So I got some tools. Now my friends can teach me each tool, right? Okay. For this tool, for this hammer, you're going to use it this way. For this saw, you're going to use it, et cetera, right? You can do that. And that's important. So that's like teaching someone, here's one, here's acceptance. Here is a reappraisal, thinking about things differently. Here's distraction or whatever. Okay. But then it's sort of on me to be able to know when to use each tool depending on what the project demands of me. If I always use the same saw because I love that saw, it's not going to work out well. The same thing, right? And resilience is knowing which tool to use when. If this is a controllable situation, I need to like try to address the problem. I need to really work through what I need to do to like plan for this and problem solve and maybe ask around and get people's advice. If this is an uncontrollable situation, I can't do that. Because if I try to do that, I'm going to drive myself crazy.
Yeah.
Because there is no solution. So I have to sort of back off, accept what's happening, maybe reappraise or distract myself and just think about things differently and take on a different tactic. So there's no one good response to everything. It's being able to recognize the demands of a situation, what's really the stressor about, and then adjusting your responses to it. That is the clearest clearest way of understanding what resilient people do. And the reason why I do positive emotions is that's one of those tools that is underdeveloped in less resilient times for less resilient people at a given time in their lives. That's the last thing on the list, right? They're focusing so heavily on this anxious thing and how do I think about this and that they forget that one of the biggest tools that we have is being able to feel positive emotions about things, imbue things with positive emotions, either in or out of the stressor.
So you're basically saying we're all capable of being resilient.
Oh yeah. Yeah.
But it really does depend on the situation.
It depends on a lot of things. And, and I'll say that we're all capable of it. We kind of have different starting lines, right? So for some of, any sort of trait or any sort of, personality or any sort of behavior, or whatever, is going to be a function of both, your hereditary, your genes, as well as your environment and upbringings, and as well as your current environment and the situation. Same thing with resilience. So that is, so we may have a little bit different starting lines. So some of us may have just hit the genetic jackpot and also been raised in a great resilience building environment. Yeah. So our starting line is a little bit closer to the finish. But some of us maybe not. And that doesn't mean that it can't be built. It means it just takes more work.
Time.
It just takes
work.
More concerted effort.
And insight,
time.
Too.
And sometimes it takes insight, but sometimes it also takes a particular moment, right? So these watershed moments.
Yeah,
I think,
you're
for example,
right.
The pandemic is one for a lot of these people where they may not have known where they stood before this, but at the end of this, what's going to happen is there's going to be this reflection. And a lot of people are going to go, you know what? That sucked a lot, but I'm still standing.
Yeah,
I'm still here.
I made it. Well, I say that every day.
And I learned something about myself, and maybe going forward, like when I, if I don't get the exact raise I want at work, I can think, but compared to the pandemic, that's maybe not as big of a deal.
Exactly. Hey, let's take another quick break. I've got so many questions. When we come back, I do want to talk about some of the habits, because that's what the title of the show is. Some of the habits to reduce fear-based, anxiety-based habits. And also, I want to talk about how resiliency is measured, okay? So hang tight again. When we come back, that's what we'll be talking about. You're listening to Brain Matters on 90.7 The Capstone.
WVUA-FM, Tuscaloosa.
This show is not a substitute for professional counseling, and no relationship is created between the show hosts or guests and any listener. If you feel you are in need of professional mental health and are a UA student, we encourage you to contact the UA Counseling Center at 348-3863. If you are not a UA student, please contact your respective county's crisis service hotline or their local mental health agency or insurance company. If it is an emergency situation, please call 911 or go to your nearest emergency room.
Listening to Brain Matters on 90.7 The Capstone. I'm BJ Gunther, and we're talking tonight about the habits of stress-resilient people. And my guest is Dr. Christian Wall from Wake Forest University. And we just ended up talking about, all different things, but how capable we all are at being resilient and the different moments in our life that trigger that, hopefully. To find out how resilient we are. Sometimes just going to college helps you learn this. Coming to the counseling center helps you learn this. Can you tell me, how is resiliency measured?
That's a really, really good question. And honestly, it's measured as many different ways as there are researchers measuring it. So one way would be through self-report scales that look a lot like these personality trait measures that speak to, you know, ask questions like, I quickly get over from being startled. I have a strong personality, these sorts of things. I'm, you know, I can persevere through, you know, through challenges and stuff like that. So that's a really popular way of doing it. It's sort of an easy way to do it. There's also in the lab types of ways where, you know, we give people challenges and stressors and we just measure how quickly they rebound from them. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So how, you know, what was their stress response as well as how quickly they recovered from it as sort of like an index of at least in this moment in time with this type of stressor, that this person seems to be fairly resilient toward.
Are there gender differences or cultural differences that you found?
So I don't really look at gender and culture, but yeah, there are definitely going to be. But it also depends on the measure. So cortisol, for example, is a stress hormone. Ooh. It's a stress hormone like any other hormone that really interacts with lots of other hormones in your body.
Yeah.
So, and as you know, like males and females tend to have different hormonal makeups. So it does interact with those. We also, one big gender difference that you see, is rumination. So rumination is the where we it's our way of taking these acute stressors, you know, that maybe happen once and then turning them into chronic stressors, right? Because you think about them and keep them alive in your mind. And women tend to be more prone to that.
Mm-hmm. Have you done any research, and this is kind of off tangent a little bit, but have you seen or done any research with individuals who are diagnosed with autism or what we used to call Asperger's? Because when you mentioned some of the, not just ruminations, but when you, in the last segment, when you mentioned something about, you know, how resilient somebody is, I immediately thought about a couple of my students from last year who were diagnosed with autism / Asperger's. I'm still going to call it that. And how difficult it is to teach them resiliency.
Yes.
Teach them
so, that. Yeah. Remember, I was talking about flexibility and rigidity.
Exactly.
And resilience is almost part and parcel of flexibility. It's really about flexibility responding to your environment. And one of the symptoms of autism is characterized by the rigidity.
Yeah, it is.
So that... It makes it difficult.
It makes it very difficult.
Not impossible.
Constant.
Not impossible.
Yeah.
You know, because a lot of times we think of resilience as a personal characteristic that sort of all belongs to you. But a lot of resilience is also engendered in our social networks and our social relationships and probably most of it, really. So one of the classic examples of this that I always love kind of thinking about is how they looked at all these children, like thousands of children, to kind of predict who would become resilient or not later on in their lives. And they discovered that, you know, having a strong sort of relationship with parents was a big deal. And that children who did not have that tended to fare worse unless they had a strong relationship with another adult member of the community, like a coach or a big brother, big sister, that type of thing, or an extended family.
Or a therapist.
So, yeah. So we're like sort of, we're thirsty for ways to become resilient, and we seek out those ways. When the traditional ways don't work, a lot of times we'll just like pivot to some other way. So to go back to your autism example, if you take a person with autism on the autism spectrum and put them in a completely new situation by themselves for an extended period of time, it's not going to go as well. But if they're in their social network, in the people who care about them most, then things are easier, right? So it's sort of, they're almost like outsourcing a little bit of their resilience to the people around them.
That's interesting that you mentioned that on your own, because I had written down a question. How does creating meaningful connections impact developing resilient students?
Not only important, it's critical.
Yes.
It's absolutely critical, because a lot of these problems we just reach. So our default state of being is connection with others. That's our default state of being. So if you think about other versions of that, right? Our default state of being is, you know, 70 degrees, you know, our right. default state of being is, you know, being nourished, right? And deviations from that are bad. And we recognize that, right? Same thing with having social connections. Our default state of being, the way we evolve and our body expects to be, is having social connections. Mm. So any deviation from that is very disruptive, and it really puts a big strain on people's ability to be resilient, for sure.
What about the habits? Let's get to the good stuff.
Yeah.
What are some habits to reduce, I guess, fear-based or anxiety-based, you know, the things that are preventing for us? Can you talk specifically about, like, this age group, college age students? What's keeping them from developing it, and what are the habits they can develop? I mean, how hard is it? Something I read today talked about a 3-step loop in developing habits. Have you heard? Maybe that's what you're about to talk about, and I don't want to steal your thunder. But the 3-step loop is, I'm going to read this from the article that I took from Psychology Today. A cue that triggers our brain to go into automatic mode. Then we follow a routine, which can be physical, mental, or emotional. And then lastly, we experience a reward. So that's how habits are formed anyway, right? So did I just steal your thunder?
No, that's one of the ways that habits are formed, right? Is through reinforcement of a behavior. The other way is just through sheer routine, right? So your ability to type right now is just through sheer routine.
And practice, yeah.
And practice, exactly. And that's really what it boils down to, is forming a routine that is connected to cues. And I think that's a really, really critical part of this. So as far as habits for resilience, I always like to start at, I'll call it the big three, physiological things that are 100% necessary for you to be a truly resilient person, I think.
Can I guess?
Sure.
Sleep. I mean, I guess eating right, but, you know, with college students, both of those, when I mention both of those, they're just like, those are out the window. You know, I always say I sound like a magazine article, because yep. It's what every magazine article says.
Yep.
But do it already. Yes. You know, that's what I say. Sleep, yes. Diet. I don't know. What's the last one?
And exercise. Sleep, diet, exercise.
Yeah. Moving your body.
And I say this not because it's like, again, a magazine article, right? But it's just our bodies expect it.
Exactly.
And our bodies evolved with that in mind, that's what it was going to get. It was going to get the right nutrients. It was going to get exercises naturally, and it was going to get some sleep. That's the default version of our body. So when we don't get those things, it goes into sort of different modes. And these different modes are weird, and they kind of throw us off. So we go into energy conservation mode. Like, we're not getting the nutrients we need or the sleep we need. So let's go into energy conservation mode, which is the same mode we get in when we are sick. Right. And again, like I was saying before, irritable and just like anxious and like very sensitive to threats in the environment and stuff like that. And it makes a ton of sense if you look at it from that perspective. Mm-hmm. So those three things are just, they're critical. You have to do those things. And then you get to the social stuff. You have to have meaningful social connections. You have to build those in. And not just asking people for help, that's important, but also just having fun with people, you know?
Yeah.
Being able to have that connection, be able to rely on others and trust others, and having others trust you and build that habit up, you know? Mm-hmm. And honestly, that's what I think, what if people like sort of the last thing that goes, you know, because people like sleep, who cares, eating, whatever, exercise, I mean, come on. And then, but you know, like that string of sociality is sort of like kind of holding me together. And that's also super critical. And then it's all about just thought habits. So thought habits, curbing rumination, you know, recognizing when there's something that's out of your control and going, what utility is this? What is this going to get me? Like right now, if I just keep thinking about it, like, is there
anything that's important for college students? Yes. Because they want immediate.
Yeah. And there's not. So let's just do something, right? Let's do something else. And building up tools to sort of can help you curb rumination and worry is like a huge, huge thing, whether it be distraction or making a plan, you know what I mean? Or just practicing mindfulness, acceptance, you know, just kind of being in the present moment. These are all ways that we can kind of trick our mind into not ruminating on things anymore. So that's kind of the, I think, big five, let's say, you know, sleeping, eating, exercise, social connections, and these sort of thought habits that keep our mind from going down the dark holes of
to where they can't turn it back. Because sometimes we will have students who come in, at least I do, I can't speak for everybody else, and what has happened is their sleep, it may be other stuff that's going on, but they won't come in for that. But they will come in when their sleep cycle is totally messed up and they cannot turn it around anymore. They will come in out of desperation. But you know, Catherine, you can speak to this too. When I tell students, because it sounds like common sense what you're talking about. It is common sense.
Yeah.
It is. And when you say that to students, I guess it's just, it is their age, some of it. You know, they want a quick fix. They think when they come in, sometimes you're going to have the magic, you know, answer for them. Something different that they haven't tried. Right. And so I have to reiterate, this stuff works. I've seen some football players who they're a hard sell. I'm going to tell you right now, the athletes are a hard sell on one end, but on the other end, they're very disciplined. So if you ask them, I'll say it that way, to do something, they're more apt to actually do it because they're so disciplined. Mm-hmm. But the guys are hard to buy into it. But with, like, for instance, you mentioned mindfulness, even relaxation apps, for instance, once they start doing it, if they can, like you say, build a routine and then it starts working and they actually buy into it, the hardest thing is to sell them on it, sell them on it and get them to buy into it. Once they buy into it and it starts working even once, they're hooked.
Yep. Yeah. And that's where that reinforcement comes in. And one way that I've talked to people in my webinars or seminars about getting that first sort of, you know, working, getting that buy-in, is actually leveraging their social connections and environment. It's much easier to go to the gym 3 times a week if you know for a fact that you have 1 or 2 other people who are counting on you and who are meeting you there and you all are accountable to each other. That helps, you know, and it also, especially with athletes, that's a big, big deal too, because this is very much of a norm-based environment. Like, what's the norm in the locker room, right? Yeah. And I want to be as close to that as possible, or else I could be really kind of on the outs. Mm-hmm. And if the norm is, hey, you know what? We're taking Monday off to do, just distract and have fun and just kind of think about other things and do some relaxation stuff, then that'll be a thing. If people are just getting, you know, if people spend 10 minutes at the locker, you know, doing mindfulness meditation, and that's just the norm, that'll be the thing.
They just have to practice it though and buy into it. We're going to take our last break, and when we come back for our final segment, I want you to talk a little more about how to sustain these habits, but also how can I, as a therapist, help students develop positive states of mind? You mentioned at the beginning of the show, positivity, positive psychology, positive states of mind. So hang on one more time and we'll take our last break and we'll be right back. You're listening to Brain Matters on 90.7, The Capstone.
WVUA-FM, Tuscaloosa.
This show is not a substitute for professional counseling, and no relationship is created between the show hosts or guests and any listener. If you feel you are in need of professional mental health and are a UA student, we encourage you to contact the UA Counseling Center at 348-3863. If you are not a UA student, please contact your respective county's crisis service hotline or their local mental health agency or insurance company. If it is an emergency situation, please call 911 or go to your nearest emergency room.
Back. You're listening to Brain Matters on 90.7 The Capstone. I'm Dr. BJ Gunther. We're talking tonight about the habits of stress-resilient people. Dr. Christian Wall from the Wake Forest University. I almost said the University of Michigan. Oh my gosh.
That's my past. Yeah.
It's been a long day, right? But from Wake Forest University is talking to us, and we left off with talking about the habits, you know, what makes somebody stress resilient. And now I want to move into how can I, as a therapist, help a student have a positive state of mind?
That's a big question.
I know it.
And we've got about two minutes. I'm not a clinician. I'm not a therapist. So I can really only speak to sort of the value of having positive states of mind and the ways that my field offers interventions to do so. And there's lots of different reasons. So there's sort of like a, two to three kind of step process or categories in doing this. One is actually having more genuine positive events in your life somehow, right? And there are like different ways to do this, right? Noticing things that you're grateful for and telling people that you're grateful for these things actually helps you sort of start having more positive emotions, because like you just become more grateful for certain
your perception changes.
Yeah, exactly. Mm-hmm. Savoring moments when you're having a particularly positive moment. So just allowing yourself to kind of be in it, present, and just savor it and not try to think about the next thing. But also when you're sort of out of those moments, having things to look forward to. I actually do a lot of research on how adaptive positive anticipation is, you know, just like the excitement of something to look forward to can really help us put things into perspective right now. Mm-hmm. But then there's also, just kind of noticing things when they're happening. Right? So they're sort of creating events, and then there's also just noticing them, being mindful, savoring, like I said just now. Mm-hmm. And then also being able to put a positive spin, or at least I don't like saying positive spin. Actually, I like saying more like injecting like a little bit of a dose of positivity into a stressful situation goes a long, long way. Yes, and I think that is actually something that people, especially younger people, struggle with a lot. I think as you age, you grow an appreciation for the fact that stressful events are not these, you know, monocolored things, that they vibrant, and there's lots of different aspects to them. And there are a lot of maybe negative things, but there are for sure positive things that go along with it. Yes. And that's fine. You can have both positive and negative coexist in one stressful event.
Right.
And people who are exhibiting resilience know that, and they recognize that, and they're able to kind of switch between the two depending on what they need. So that sort of, recognition that there can be positive things, positive aspects of these stressful situations is absolutely critical. And I think a lot of times people almost get offended by that. Like, if you suggest that there's like some sort of positive part of the situation, then you're demeaning how bad I feel about the situation. And it's like, no, we're not demeaning it. You can feel horrible about the situation and also recognize that there may be positive elements in it at the same time. Those two are not opposite. They can coexist. And just accepting that those two can coexist, right now, just accepting it opens up a whole doors of possibilities for them to
recognize
the positive and pay attention to it.
Some of these kids have not even been given that option. Maybe like you said, the way they grew up, the way they were raised, maybe that was never given to them as an option. And just opening that door for them makes them see it in such a different light. And another thing, Christian, you know, I think surrounding yourself, you're not going to be able to surround yourself with positive people all the time. And frankly, sometimes that just will get on your nerves. Okay. Yeah, you know, sometimes you just don't want that. But I see a lot of students who are surrounded by toxic people. And I finally, you know, they might not see it because they are in the middle of it. And I have to point that out to them sometimes and say, look, these people, these are not really your friends. They're toxic for you, or they're negative.
Nellie, you're stress
negaholics, enablers. I call them.
Yeah. Yeah. They're your enablers of stress. Exactly. And the, you know, because commiserating is, can be very,
it's bonding.
Yeah. It can be kind of fun a little bit. Right. Mm-hmm. But it's, it has its time and place. Yeah. And the next step is to move past it and feel these positive emotions and allow yourself to feel good about things, even in times of stress, knowing that it's not demeaning your stress. It's actually complementary to it and can help you keep the overall stress in like sort of the right place, if you will.
Yeah. Last thing, do you have any resources for anybody who's listening? Any resources?
Yeah. So if you want to learn about stress in the body, there's a book called Why Zebras Don't Get Ulcers.
Yeah.
By Robert Sapolsky, which is just phenomenal. So about, I don't know, 14, 15 years ago now, I think, but it still holds up. And it's a great, great book on how stress affects the body, and it really goes through the whole, all the systems. there's also a book by my former mentor, Barbara Fredrickson, called, you know, Positivity. Okay. And it's nice about getting, it has features a lot of our research in it and other research of others on positive emotions and how those work and help. There's also a resilience book, Resilience, the Science of Mastering Life's Greatest Challenges, by Southwick and Charney. That is, and these Southwick and Stephen Southwick and Dennis Charney are big researchers in the science of resilience. So I tend to focus on really books that are written by scientists who are doing the research, because they have a lot, they're very nuanced take on things and aren't so kind of pushing certain things or certain other things.
Yeah.
They really try to provide a holistic view on resilience and positive emotions and stress management and all that stuff.
Well, thank you so much. That's wonderful. The hour always goes by quickly.
Yeah, absolutely.
When it's an interesting topic, you know?
Yeah, absolutely, yeah.
And most all of our shows, I feel like for me, are very interesting. I'm always learning something new, and I've learned something new tonight. Thank you so much for being on the
show.
My pleasure. I know you're an hour ahead. I have relatives in Winston-Salem, so I have a connection to Wake. My nephew-in-law just graduated from law school there. I have a connection to William & Mary, your alma mater.
Yeah.
Love William & Mary. Used to travel every year with my parents by train.
Oh, wow. That's awesome.
So I'm very familiar. Know that place like Williamsburg?
Yeah, it's
the back of my hand.
Colonial Williamsburg.
Love it. Love it. Yeah. Love it. I miss it because we haven't been in a few years. But thanks again for being on the show. And
my
take
pleasure.
Care.
And thanks for having me.
I'll let you know when this goes up on Apple Podcasts soon.
Awesome.
After it's edited. Thanks so much. I'm going to make a few announcements like I always do. Don't forget, I just mentioned our shows are recorded and podcasted. They're on the Apple Podcasts, audioboom.com and voices.ua.edu. Just type in Brain Matters and you'll find some of our past shows. There's also a link to voices.ua.edu on our Counseling Center website at counseling.ua.edu. I want to make a quick announcement. This week is our Suicide Awareness Week, and it culminates in the Out of the Darkness Suicide Awareness Walk, which is on Sunday. If you're interested, it's this coming Sunday, which would be October the 10th. So if you're interested, just call us here at the Counseling Center, or you can go on our website and see the calendar. It's counseling.ua.edu. We'd love to have you participate. I always like to thank a few people who've made the show possible. Our executive director here at the Counseling Center, Dr. Greg Vanderwall, Terry Siggers of the Office of Student Media. My production assistant, of course, is Catherine Howell. My colleagues at the Counseling Center and the WVUA staff who helps us edit the show. And of course, my guest tonight, Dr. Christian Wall. Don't forget, we're on next week, and Our show will feature a guest who was used to be an actual intern here and went on to get his license. He's working at another university, and the show is how neurofeedback helps with anxiety, test anxiety, ADHD, other mental health issues. So that should be a great show. So tune in next week at the same time. Thanks again for listening, and good night.
This show is not intended as a substitute for professional counseling. Further, the views, opinions, and conclusions expressed by the show hosts or their guests are their own and not necessarily those of the University of Alabama, its officers, or trustees. Any views, opinions, or conclusions shared on the show do not create a relationship between the host or any guest and any listener, and such a relationship should never be inferred. If you feel you're in need of professional mental health and are a UA student, please contact the UA Counseling Center at 348-3863. If you are not a UA student, please contact your respective county's crisis service hotline or their local mental health agency or insurance company. If it is an emergency situation, please call 911 or go to your nearest emergency room.